Some blood-spattered clothes, that's all Jacob had to cling to. And these clothes immediately meant the worst. His other children didn't need to say a word. Because to Jacob it was clear his beloved Joseph was dead, torn to pieces by wild animals. The only conclusion you could draw. And he didn't even have a body to bury. Just that infamous coat that he'd given his son. And when the callous siblings tried to comfort their father, Jacob rightly said, "No, in mourning will I go down to the grave to my son." It's a pitiful scene. And from that moment, the sparkle departed Jacob's eyes, the sense of hope from his life. He saw nothing ahead except grief. Parents should never have to bury their children. It's simply wrong. It's not the way things should be. Nicholas Wolterstorff is a philosophy professor at Yale University, and he's a Christian. In 1983, his 25-year-old son Eric was killed on the slopes of an alpine mountain. And so all who had known Eric were never the same again. And Wolterstorff assembled his confused and agonized thoughts into a book called Lament for a Son. And it's searingly honest. Let me read a few bits from it. "Innocent questions make me wince. Will the family all be home for Christmas? What am I to say? Yes, I say, we'll all be home. What are your children doing these days? I go down the list. Amy, Robert, Klaas, Christopher, but I omit one. Do I call attention to the omission or do I let it pass? How many children do you have? What do I say? 4 or 5? 5, I usually say. Sometimes I explain, sometimes I don't." Earlier on in the book, he writes this: "When Eric's body arrived back from Europe on Saturday, Claire insisted on seeing it. She was right. I pity those who never get a chance to see and feel the deadness of the one they love, who must think death but cannot see it. To fully persuade us of death's reality and of its grim finality, our eyes and hands must rub against death's cold, hard body, body against body, painfully. Knowing death with mind alone is less than fully knowing it." But Jacob only had that coat. He only knew Joseph's death in his mind. And it's common, of course, for the recently bereaved to think they've seen the person they mourn. I don't know, down the street, in the shops, getting onto the tube, they just see the back of a head. It's part of the yearning to see again, a longing to cheat reality, a longing to cheat death, which I guess must have made Jacob terrified of his usual disappointment when his other sons told him at the end of chapter 45 that Joseph was actually alive. It meant, you see, that either they were lying to him now or they'd lied to him all those years before. What a terrible dilemma. But when he was convinced, just look at his reaction in chapter 45, verse 28. "The spirit of their father Jacob revived. He said, 'I'm convinced my son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.'" It seemed too good to be true. It wasn't too good to be true. It was so good because it was true. And as you would expect, when he discovered his son was still alive, Jacob's life was transformed. And not just his life. His death, too, was transformed. And not just Jacob's life and death. Because, you see, I am not exaggerating when I say that the life and death of the entire human race was transformed. All because this man, Joseph, who was thought to be dead, is now actually alive. So let's think about this. First of all, Jacob's future transformed. You may remember when we started this series off a few weeks ago, looking at Joseph's life, the Genesis actually begins the section entitled in chapter 37, "This is the account of Jacob." Well, perhaps I think in our passage we now begin to get a bit more sense of it, because actually in these chapters tonight, Jacob is the center of attention. His grief turned to joy. Now, it's not to say that he was without nerves. So at the start of chapter 46, we find that God meets Jacob and calms his fears. Look at what he says. "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I'll surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes." Jacob receives this divine promise. You see, I guess that Jacob had been clinging to his grandfather Abraham's hope that one day God would transform this tiny little family into a great nation, to be a blessing to the world. But so many obstacles stood in the way. First, the family was, in global terms at least, minute. And now, at this point, it looked as if this family would be wiped out by famine. And at each point along the way in Genesis' story, each point, trusting God seemed to be absurd. It seemed to be the last thing you should do. And yet now things yet again are looking up. Joseph had been strategically placed in Egypt to provide sanctuary for this family during the famine. And what's more, God says to Jacob, "I'll go with you." Just as he promised always to go with his people, so he will go with Jacob, and he'd make them a great nation in Egypt. But that did not mean he'd forgotten his promises about a land of their own. And so even at this stage, he reinforces the hope that they, one day, will go back. In other words, "Jacob, it's okay, it's safe for you to go to Egypt." So much for the national future. What of Jacob's? Well, it's a dream come true. Just look at those last words of verse 4. "When you breathe your last, your son Joseph will be the one to close your eyes." A grieving father's impossible dream. But of course, what of grieving parents since? It was all right for Jacob. What about people now? What about the people like Nicholas Walterstorff and many, many others? Is there any comfort for them? Well, not yet. For this was a unique event in the Bible story. Just like the childless couples in Genesis who suddenly have children against all the odds, against all the biological odds. That doesn't mean that everybody can suddenly have children. This certainly doesn't mean that everybody will suddenly see their lost son revived. But just hang in there to see why this matters so much to us all. Secondly, we see Jacob's death prepared, that he's prepared for it. Look down at the end of the chapter in verse 29. "Joseph had his chariot made ready and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And as soon as Joseph appeared before him, he threw his arms round his father and wept for a long time. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Now I am ready to die, since I've seen for myself that you're still alive.'" It's an astonishing moment in both men's lives, isn't it? But I wonder if it rang bells. I guess it's almost, well, it's a bit like a mirror image of Jesus' classic story of the prodigal or wayward son returning home. Except here, it's not the father running, it's the son, desperate to meet his father, going out to meet him and clinging to him. But even more significant is the parallel Jacob has with another New Testament figure. You remember old Simeon? Luke describes how he worked in the Jerusalem temple and, in Luke's words, was waiting for the consolation of Israel. How it had been revealed to Simeon that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Christ, the Messiah, the King. And when Simeon held this tiny, fragile baby in his arms, he said this, "As you have promised, now dismiss your servant in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to your people Israel." Simeon could now face death with confidence because of this one life being born. And also for Jacob, he can now die, since he's seen and held his very own son in his arms. And that changes everything. But you see, it's not just about an old man's grief turned to joy. The fact of this man, Joseph, being alive changes his family's fortunes as well. So secondly, we see God's blessing shared. Now, it's quite something to have the ear of a monarch, isn't it? I don't know how many people here have the ears of monarchs. Well, when you're in the presence of monarchy, you really have to know who you're talking to and how to behave. And Alan Bennett tells a classic story of a receptionist at BBC Television Centre. When the King of Norway arrived to pay a visit to the Director of Programming. No idea what he was doing there and what he wanted to find out, but he was there nevertheless. And the receptionist called up to the office in question, had a few discreet words, and then turned back to the distinguished visitor. She said, "I'm sorry, did you say the King of Norway or the King of Sweden?" Most unfortunate. Now, fortunately, Joseph knew better than that. He knew exactly who he was dealing with, and he knew exactly how to talk to the king. And he concocted a very cunning plan to make sure his refugee family found protection in this foreign land. After all, when you travel abroad anywhere, it's good to have people on the ground who know their way around, you know where the backstreet shortcuts are, know how to avoid the sort of cultural faux pas. And of course, immigration has always been a political hot potato since the birth of nation states. And it was bound to have been a difficult issue in ancient Egypt at a time of famine. But Joseph knows what he's doing. He makes sure that his family is not coming under false pretenses, and he promises that they'll work to provide food. They'll be shepherds and herdsmen. They're not going to be a drain on national resources. They'll contribute. And sure enough, Pharaoh gets the point. And after hearing the brothers out, in good old sort of monarchical fashion, he has a quiet word with his prime minister. There in verse 5 of chapter 47. "Your father and your brothers have come to you, and the land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and brothers in the best part of the land. Let them live in Goshen. And if you know of any among them with special ability, put them in charge of my own livestock." Fantastic. It's a win-win situation. The family's safe under the king's protection. They've got the best part of the land. And the king gets some new employees who are so grateful to him, they'll do anything for him. What a blessing. This family is safe at a time of acute danger. But of course, if you've been with us over the last few weeks, you'll know that nothing in Joseph's story happens by chance. Despite all the peaks and troughs of life, there is a steady hand on the tiller. For yes, Pharaoh blessed the family of Jacob, but who caused that to happen? The promise-making God, who blesses his people by giving them favor in the eyes of this king. He brought them to this place so that they be protected. And what's more, again as he promised Abraham, he blesses others through this family. It's all because of God. And all because God put this man, Joseph, in the right place at the right time. And as if to emphasize who really is at the center of attention, what happens next is quite extraordinary. Because Pharaoh has blessed Jacob's family, but now it's as if the shoe's on the other foot. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh wants to meet Joseph's dad, fair enough. And this ancient man is ushered into his presence. Now, normally when you ask somebody's age, it's considered rude, but I guess if you're the king, you can do anything you like. And for kings to ask that is, I suppose, not rude. But Jacob's response is poignant. Do you see that? Verses 9 and 10. "The years of my pilgrimage are 130. Well, that's not bad going. My years have been few. Well, that's one way of putting it, I suppose. Few and difficult. And they do not equal the years of pilgrimage of my fathers." No, he sees himself as part of a longer story. It's not just him. But he's not wrong when he says his life has been difficult. I mean, the contrast between the lives of this old herdsman and this enthroned Pharaoh could not have been more marked. But I wonder if you notice that throughout the story so far, the writer seems to seesaw between this old man's two names. At one moment he's called Jacob, at another moment he's called Israel. It's the same man. Jacob, literally the deceiver, the fraud. Israel, the man of faith who struggled with God, who trusted God. Now here, he's Jacob. Because of all the scrapes, the hardships that his lies and deceits had got him into. For a lot of the things he suffered, he had only himself to blame, but not always. He was the victim of other deceits as well. He'd lived on the run, and he'd been in fear for years. He'd seen his family tear itself apart out of jealousies and hatreds. His was indeed a hard life. And yet, somehow, he'd come through. Because you see, this Jacob, the deceiver, is also Israel. The one who struggled with God and who clung to God for a blessing, which is the last and only resort of a man in trouble, isn't it? And because God is like he is, Jacob found blessing when he clung to God. And here, near the end of Jacob's life, he is able to share that blessing. Look at verse 10. Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. Yet again, a Gentile, a pagan, who did not know the God of Abraham, finds himself being blessed by this family. I don't know about you, but reading this story, we can't help feeling that far from an audience with Pharaoh, the king was actually the one who enjoyed an audience with Jacob. But remember, all of this came about because one man was alive and not dead, Joseph. The son who was thought to be dead, but is in fact very much alive, and is not just the family who reap the benefits from this prime minister's time in office. So thirdly, we see two nations preserved. Now, I feel the need to point out the completely obvious. We're dealing with here an age before satellite weather forecasting, before modern communications, before UN relief agencies, before social welfare, before modern transport systems, before Live Aid stadium rock shows or street collectors standing outside tube stations. In the face of tragedies like cyclones and famines and earthquakes and volcanoes, there was nothing you could do. And there was no one to help. Unless there was someone who knew what was going on, who somehow had an inkling of what was to come, who could somehow be ready with that ancient, desperate goal of disaster preparedness. And in ancient Egypt, there was one such, Prime Minister Joseph Bar Jacob. God had revealed to him what would happen, and therefore this prime minister acted and set up grain stores. But that was only half the solution. How would, you see, of course, it's one thing to have the food, but how would people make ends meet after their farms, their livelihoods have been reduced to desert? Well, there was a surprising international relief effort. Look at verse 21 of chapter 47. You ready for this? Joseph reduced the people to servitude from one end of Egypt to the other. It's not quite what you're expecting, is it? That's a bolt from the blue. Not really the hero now, is he? It sounds appalling to modern ears, doesn't it? I mean, taken out of context, Joseph could be made to look like a power-crazed dictator who's compounding the misfortunes of those under his sway by turning them into his subjects and slaves. But careful. This is a classic example why we must handle the Bible responsibly. Because actually, you see, in the ancient world, there was only one solution to this sort of disaster. Slavery. It's the only option. Look at chapter 47, verse 19, because you see there that this is what the people ask for. They say, "Why should we perish before your eyes, we and our land as well? Buy us and our land in exchange for food, and we with our land will be in bondage to Pharaoh. Give us seed so that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become desolate." Seems extraordinary to you and me, doesn't it? But being under the sway of the king as a slave was far, far better than being a free man dying of starvation. And so in verse 20, we see that Joseph gives them exactly what they want. National welfare is preserved. Food can be distributed to all those working for the good of the nation. And the people realized it. Look at verse 25. "You saved our lives. May we find favor in the eyes of our Lord. We will be in bondage to Pharaoh." This is a cause for rejoicing. You see, slavery in the ancient world didn't necessarily imply cruelty or oppression. It meant protection and life, which, of course, is completely up God's street, isn't it? God is profoundly concerned about human life. He is concerned about people's welfare, body, mind, and spirit. He is a God who cares about the physically hungry. And if we are like him, so should we be. But for the children of Abraham, this was still just the beginning. As promised, the Israelites settle in Goshen. In verse 27, they acquire property and grew in number. None of that would have been possible if they'd stayed in Canaan. They would have died. None of that would have been possible without the man of the hour being alive, Joseph. Now they had a future. They had a hope. But this was still just the beginning. Look at verse 29. "When the time drew near for Israel to die, he called for his son Joseph and said to him, 'If I found favor in your eyes, put your hand under my thigh and promise that you'll show me kindness and faithfulness. Do not bury me in Egypt. But when I rest with my fathers, carry me out of Egypt and bury me where they are buried.' Joseph said, 'I'll do as you say. Swear to me, he said. Then Joseph swore to him, and Israel worshipped as he leaned on top of his staff." Did you notice that? He's Israel here, not Jacob. This is the man who trusts God, not the deceiver Jacob. Why? Because he trusts not only that his descendants will be able to return to the promised land, but also that he will be buried there. And for that to happen, well, of course, he turns to the only one he can trust to pass on the message to the next generation, his son Joseph. You see, this is a man who has endured some of life's toughest challenges, but he trusts God to keep his promises, even if it means only future generations will see it in their lifetimes. But of course, when we get to the New Testament and the writer of Hebrews looks back over the great models of trust from the Bible, in Hebrews chapter 11, here is Jacob, Israel, commended for blessing his sons, as we'll see next week, and for worshipping God on his staff. In other words, for trusting God for the future. Well, as we try and bring all these things together, in summary, in the storyline of Genesis, it's all because this man Joseph is alive. Because of him, another descendant of Jacob would be able to be born generations later. And he would follow in his great uncle Joseph's footsteps. He would suffer in extraordinary ways, as a result of which his own father would suffer intolerable grief and agony. For this one would not just appear to die, he would die. He would be executed by his extended family and tribe, who would act in league with Gentiles, the very people this tribe was meant to be a blessing for. And people would be in despair. Do you remember those two who left Jerusalem a day or two after the crucifixion? And they were in the pit of depression as they headed out to a town called Emmaus. And they said this, "We had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel. But of course he wasn't." What a vain hope. He was executed. He died, didn't he? And as they say to this strange companion, you say, "Are you the only one who doesn't know about this? It's all over." But of course it wasn't, because the one who was dead was also made alive. And that changed everything. You see, the result of his suffering is that he's able to offer life and food to all who come to him. Yes, that means being his slave, becoming a slave of the Christ. But being the Christ slave is, of course, perfect freedom. Yes, that means coming down on our knees in desperation for mercy, in famine, desperation, looking for food, but knowing that we can find mercy, life, and joy at his feet. You see, Joseph was great, but Jesus was the greatest. Joseph preserved two nations, and that was all God's purpose. But the result of that is Jesus would save all nations who came to him. All nations who came to him. Joseph only appeared to die and live, but Jesus did die and live and never would die again. You see, Jesus' victory is therefore a victory beyond the realms of this life and world. It's a victory that sustains us in the very hour of our deaths. Jacob just had a tiny glimpse of that. Simeon understood a little more. But we have the whole picture. But what of those who suffer in this life? What of those who grieve lost children or who look out over cyclone-ravaged floodlands? What about them? Well, there are no glib or easy answers. And those who have died do not come back in this life. And yet, in the face of that brick wall of death, there is comfort. There is even hope. Because you see, in Christ, there is life beyond the grave because of what Jesus took to the grave and conquered at the grave. A final selection from Wolterstorff. Look at how he coped with his grief. He said this, "How is faith to endure, O God, when you allow all this scraping and tearing on us? You've allowed rivers of blood to flow, mountains of suffering to pile up, sobs to become humanity's song, all without lifting a finger that we could see. You've allowed bonds of love beyond number to be painfully snapped. If you've not abandoned us, explain yourself, God." And we strain to hear. But instead of hearing an answer, we catch sight of God himself scraped and torn. Through our tears, we see the tears of God. A new and more disturbing question now arises. Oh God, why do you permit yourself to suffer? If the death of the devout costs you dear, as the psalmist said, why do you permit it? Why do you not grasp at joy? And of course, the answer to that must be, he did it because he loves us. But love in Christ can conquer death, not to bring people back to life in this life, but to bring people through to life in the next life. That is the grounds of our faith in the darkest hour. That is what the God of Jacob, the God of Joseph, and the God of Jesus offers to each one of us. And that is what we remember around this table. Let's pray. Christ is our peace. He has reconciled us to God in one body by the cross. We meet in his name and share his peace. The peace of the Lord be always with you, and also with you.